don't have the author of this reading. I know, though, that it was found. I know that it was found in a book of poetry and readings by immigrants and refugees. Don't look at me as though I am an alien or a stranger. Don't let the dagger of antipathy fly out of your eyes. I am your neighbor. Don't call me a foe, an antagonist, or a rival. Don't roll up your mistrustful sleeves for a fight. I am your friend. Don't hold this murderous weapon in your kind hand. Don't deny me the right to work, to eat, to live. I am your brother. I am your sister. If destiny willed me to be born on this side of the frontier line, if my parents wished me to wear these clothes and taught me their own dances, do we have to be adversaries? If fate desired me to speak this tongue foreign to you and our skin's color to differ, do we have to be competitors? Is there not enough? If necessity decided for us to live in this country, in the north, south, east, or west, do we have to be opponents? If I believe in Jesus, Jehovah, Krishna, Buddha, Brahma, or Allah, if this is my philosophy, my tradition, my history, and my culture, do we have to be enemies? No, a million times no. Please look at me with new eyes and throw away your injurious prejudices. What do you see but a person like you who wants, desires, and hopes for the same things in life? Well-being, happiness, a home, family, some friends, some love. Look, I walk, I talk, I eat, I sleep, I dream, I laugh, and I cry. Just like you. I'm born, I grow up, I learn, I suffer, I bleed, and I die. Just like you. I'm a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, a son, and a daughter. You see, we are alike. We are the same. We are sisters. We are brothers. Listen to me, my neighbor, my friend, and my ally. I am telling you the truth. We are all victims of schemes we would rather not be living in. Please listen to me. It's true. We are brothers. We are sisters. Let us, therefore, with irresistible will, cross all frontier lines that the past has erected between us, thus making divisions vanish. Let us with supreme power break the bonds of history, religion, and culture, and run into each other's arms. Let us uproot from our tormented hearts thorny mistrust that was planted there thousands of years ago. Let us seize ammunition from destructive hatred and make our war capitulate. Let us sink the cholera of bitterness in the affectionate sea of universal accord. And finally, let us unite and march to higher claims, to incomparable glory, where peace can blossom today between us. Thus both of us will go to sleep at last, fearless of each other tonight. This space, this worship space, some people, including myself, call the sanctuary. We come here, we might say, to have some time out of time, to be spiritually refreshed, to have haven with members and friends of repair and rest and inspiration and beauty and love. It is a place of belonging and welcoming, and a sanctuary for the growing of our souls. Offering sanctuary can have another meaning, too. The tradition of religious sanctuary goes back to ancient times. The Old Testament mentions safe haven at the altar for criminals who committed accidental murder, and even suggests the establishment of 6 cities of refuge. By around the 4th century, the right to sanctuary had become formalized among the early Christians. Churches continued to offer actual physical sanctuary for hundreds of years. By the early 1200s, English criminals could hide out for 40 days at a church and then accept abjuration of the realm or permanent exile on the property of that church. The principle of sanctuary has declined in the years since the Reformation, actually. But in the 1980s, in this country, many churches chose to offer sanctuary to refugees from Central America, particularly Nicaragua, people who were in extreme danger in their own country because of their political stances. There is a new call from the Reverend Peter Morales for Unitarian Universalist churches to consider becoming involved in providing sanctuary for immigrants who may be facing more deportation, people who are undocumented but who are contributing members of our country and whose deportation would destroy family unity or whose deportation would put them at great risk. 2 other First Parish members and I recently attended a workshop on becoming a sanctuary church. It does not seem, we thought, and in conversation with others, that we have the kind of physical space required and or available resources to actually harbor people here, although there are some within our community here who are considering the facilitation of our becoming a support congregation for churches like Bedford, who have already built showers in their church to do this. This would mean that we would support them in some way by our presence, by food, by clothes, that sort of support. There isn't a law that says if a person is on a church property, they will not be arrested. But as the history of the modern sanctuary movement, we learned that day, no one who has been provided sanctuary in a church has been deported. ICE or whatever organization is doing that difficult work do not tend to want the publicity of snagging somebody off of religious property and deporting them. So it is about a year-long commitment to a person or a family that whose intent is to publicize the lives and the needs of people here undocumented and what deporting them would bring. If there's any doubt that there are vulnerable people in our land at all times, we know that that is true, and we think particularly at this particular time. But as Rebecca said, regardless of who you voted for, it seems to be true that some hard-fought rights for some groups of people, women, the GLBTQ community, special needs students, many millions who receive health care through the Affordable Care Act, and of course the very planet that sustains all life, are being put in more vulnerable positions. We don't know for sure, but it's difficult not to think and believe that. And even as I want to honor political differences about policy and lesser stances, those things that healthily ebb and flow in a healthy democracy, I also believe that it is in our DNA as Unitarian Universalists, in our principles, in our history, that is so closely aligned with the development of democracy, and in the life of this congregation over the years, to consider our role going forward in protecting the basic civil rights of those of us on the community of Earth whose rights may be threatened. Yesterday, like many of you, and with some of you, I attended the march in Boston. When we were singing Holly Near's song, I had to chuckle at the dear propensity of people at marches like these to include everybody on the speaker's rostrum. Every possible group, every possible variation of humanity. And if you were there, you know that that went on for 2.5 hours. All of them had seats. All of us were standing out there on the common. I understood it, but I didn't necessarily enjoy it for that long. It was a true experience in diversity on most any level you can name, except probably party affiliation, although that wouldn't have to be the case, I suppose. At one point, we were asked to face someone we did not know and look into their eyes and to say with our eyes that we were standing with them side by side, that we were in solidarity with them. I felt resistance to doing this. A kind of shy, embarrassed resistance of looking someone straight in the eyes for longer than 10 seconds and not saying anything. But I complied and looked into the eyes of a young man in front of me. He was Muslim. As we looked, and with 120,000 other people, everything became silent there on the common. Both he and I wept. Many people around me had tears in their eyes. There was a sense for me of the bonds we human beings have that are so much deeper and so much more powerful than mere categories of difference. Without a word, we went together to the sanctuary of our sameness, to the love that transcends all difference. Pause here to tell you that I had intended using the video projector today. It wished not to participate. So at this point, I was going to show a video of a young man, a refugee from Somalia, and what his journey was like. And I will email those to you and also put them on the website. They're extraordinarily wonderful ways to not stay separate from what it's like, for instance, to be a refugee. I might as well confess, because it will probably get around the rumor mill anyway, that I had what can only be described as a panic attack there yesterday after standing dead center in this huge mass of people for a long time. It was okay, we stood for all that time, and praise be, we were told the march was going to start and given directions on how it would go. Of course, no one planned for how long it would take for 120,000 people to walk away from the Boston Common and onto the street. It took hours, frankly, and at some point, as we were standing there, maybe a half hour after we were told the march was going to start, I got anxious about being in a place where there was no route to move. Not a huge surprise for me, because I do tend to have somewhat of a claustrophobic nature. So I knew that I couldn't stay there for whatever length of time it would take. And I said to my allies there, "I'm leaving. I don't want you to leave. I'm okay." It took me an hour to swim upriver through all those people. It was a nightmare. And yet, a few First Parish people there with me were supportive, and all those people along the way who were opening up this sea of flesh and urging me on to make my way through the crowd, I thought they were giving active sanctuary moment by moment by moment to me, and it was a very beautiful and compelling experience that I had, as well as a nightmare. So two possible meanings: that this physical space is sometimes a haven for those of us who are already here, and other times it is a space for the consideration of who beyond our walls needs active protection from us. I mean, from us, yes. Sometimes facing such realities here in worship is not comfortable or peaceful, and yet it is part of the best of religious tradition to do so. There isn't a person in this room, I think, who does not know something about being the other. Many of us are more privileged than many others in the world, and still we have had some experience of extreme vulnerability, of being unsafe, of being cast out of the protections that others have, either by our physical nature, by who we love, by whether we work in the right places, whether we work at all, how much money we have, whether we're old or young, whether we are partnered or not. All of us know something of that vulnerability. It is my belief that the recognition of our mutual vulnerability is what is required for humanity to survive and to thrive, let alone thrive, I should say. Religion at its best teaches compassion and service, love and solidarity as bridges to that recognition. I read this poem by Hafiz, Sufi poet from the 4th century. We have not come here to take prisoners, but to surrender ever more deeply to freedom and joy. We have not come into this exquisite world to hold ourselves hostage from love. Run, my dear, from anything that may not strengthen your precious budding wings. Run like hell, my dear, from anyone likely to put a sharp knife into the sacred, tender vision of your beautiful heart. We have a duty to befriend those aspects of obedience that stand outside of our house and shout to our reason, oh, please, come out and play. For we have not come here to take prisoners or to confine our wondrous spirits, but to experience ever and ever more deeply our divine courage, freedom, and light. Muslim poet Hafiz. To feel as if we belong, I think, is one of the great triumphs of human existence, and especially to sustain a life of belonging and to invite others into that. It's interesting to think that it could be so that our sense of woundedness around not belonging is actually one of our core competencies. That though the crow is just itself, and the stone is just itself, and the mountain is just itself, and the cloud and the sky are just themselves, we are one of the chief parts of creation, one of them, that knows what it is like to live in exile, and to know that the ability to turn our faces toward home is one of the great human endeavors and great human stories. Most people in Western culture know the story of Moses, who was in exile his entire life. He was never out of it, never home. 40 years in the desert with his people, but we know at the end of the story that before he died, he looked out over the Holy Land, that turning his face and the face of his people in that direction made all the difference. I believe that when we as persons or people live in a constant state of alert because we have been labeled the other by history or laws or power or systems or rhetoric or unexamined cultural norms, it weakens all of us. It can be said, I believe, that those who seek to take basic rights away from fellow humans have somewhere within themselves a place where they feel very threatened and unsafe themselves. So I had planned today for this not to be a factual or specific call to action or a rant or a polemic, rather a time to really connect with that basic universal human experience of displacement or otherness, or being the person cast out of the circle of safety and freedom, to open our hearts and our spirits to this reality in our living. I was going to show a video that many of you have seen of a man. I guess it happened all over the world where Muslim men blindfolded themselves and stood in public squares with a sign that said, "Do you trust me? I trust you. Hug me." And it sounds, you know, I guess a little schmaltzy if you look on it at the face, but if you watch it, especially the one in London, it's quite a beautiful dance of our desire to love one another. And so many people went up to him and hugged him, and when his sign fell down, one young man just made it his job to keep putting it back up because the wind kept blowing it over. Now, this man saw none of this. He was just there being hugged by people, many, many different kinds of people. And it just reminds me that it is my belief that deeply within, under our fear and under our need to protect ourselves, is that desire to connect with others in that way. It is in that shared space when we might be someone in need of sanctuary, or we may be one that can provide it, that is the truest inner sanctuary of all. Linda Hogan is a Native American poet, and she used this metaphor from nature to speak of this. There is a place at the center of the earth where one ocean dissolves inside the other in a black and holy love. It's why the whales of one sea no songs of the other. Oh, it's okay. Through centuries, we can see and look back and be discouraged, perhaps, by the many ways we've not lived out of this consciousness of needing to know each other's songs. But every time we act and speak and remember the other way, there is a healing and a reconciliation to the truest universal human sanctuary. When Paul Robeson was denied, do you know Paul Robeson, the bass, like baritone, I guess, singer in the 1950s, African-American, who was a victim of the McCarthy era and racism, of course, and was disallowed, could not leave the United States. So what did he do but went to the border with a lot of people, and across the border were other people waiting to hear, and he sang across the border. And Naomi Nye writes this about that. Paul Robeson stood on the northern border and sang into Canada, where a vast audience sat on folding chairs waiting to hear him. He sang into Canada. His voice left the USA when his body was not allowed to cross that line. Remind us again, my brave friend, what countries may we sing into? What songs travel toward us from far away to deepen our days? There's much we can do to stay in our hearts around what it's like to be an immigrant, to be a refugee. And we're going to be called to grapple with the issue of the millions of refugees moving from many places in the world. And William Shire, a poet, writes this: no one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. Your neighbors running faster than you, breath bloody in their throats. The boy you went to school with, who kissed you dizzy behind the old tin factory, is holding a gun bigger than his body. You only leave home when home won't let you stay. You have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. No one burns their palms under trains beneath carriages. No one spends days and nights in the stomach of a truck feeding on newspaper unless the miles traveled mean something more than mere journey. No one crawls under fences. No one wants to be beaten and pitied. No one chooses refugee camps or strip searches where your body is left aching, or prison because prison is safer than your city of fire. I want to go home, but home is the mouth of a shark. I hope you will take time to look at the videos that I'll send you links to. I've read this before, also by Naomi Nye, who's a great poet and storyteller. She's Palestinian, but she's raised in America. And this is an example of active in the moment sanctuary, and I'll end with this. After learning my flight was detained 4 hours, I heard the announcement, "If anyone in the vicinity of 4A understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately." Well, one pauses these days. Gate 4A was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing loudly. "Help," said the flight service person. "Talk to her. What is her problem?" We told her the flight was going to be 4 hours late, and she did this. I put my arm around her and spoke to her haltingly. "Shu dao ashu biduk habitati, stani stani shwe min fadlik. Shobit sewi." It's a question. The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought our flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for some major medical treatment the following day. I said, "No, no, we're fine. You'll get there. Just late. Who is picking you up? Let's call him and tell him." We called her son, and I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got to the plane and would ride next to her, Southwest. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took up to 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling about her life, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamoul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbling mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, out of her bag, and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the traveler from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar. And smiling, "There are no better cookies than that." And then the airline broke out the free beverages from huge coolers, non-alcoholic. And the two little girls for our flight, one African-American, one Mexican-American, ran around serving us all apple juice and lemonade, and they were covered with powdered sugar, too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing, with green furry leaves, such an old country traveling tradition. Always carry a plan, always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around the gate of late and weary ones and thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person at this gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, has seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies, I wanted to hug all these other people too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost.